During the years, 7 years, 1930 to 1937, a violent atmosphere prevailed in Vermont. Sometimes this was very intense violence, other times relatively mild. Now, when there is such an atmosphere, and you consider the causes of why there should be that such intense feelings aroused. I mentioned four. One was fear. Fear of young people being taken away from them and joining not looking to them. And said that we were perverting the young. Two, there were statements in the Hymns of Lear which aroused the feelings, such as the statement that not seeing that the Third Testament had an internal sense to be manifested in the doctrine of the church had kept the church as a whole in a purely natural state, and thus the Lord had remained unthroned in the church. Now, these things were taken personally. Did not intend it to mean that anyone were not those in the church who were relatively internal, but it was a doctrinal statement that as long as one remains in the literal sense of the word, one remains in a natural state. The church remains in a natural state. It was not a personal judgment, but was taken as such. And the same in regard to the Lord remained enthroned in the church. You see that the internal sense which makes heaven is the Lord's throne. If the internal sense is not perceived in the Third Testament, then that throne is lacking. These things were, as I said, taken as personal attacks on the church, the way they were not meant. In fact, when these statements were made in Holland, they weren't thinking of Vernathen particularly, or the heads of the church. It was just a doctrinal statement. See, lots of people have said that the whole question was a personal one. A lot of personal feelings came into it, but essentially it was not in any sense a personal thing. Three was some. There was a sincere belief that this was a heresy which would destroy the church. Now, to understand that, you have to realize that there were heresies in the new church which were really destructive, and which, seen superficially, appeared to have some similarity to the Hymns of Lear. But this was there was in the church what was called the celestial heresy. This heresy was sometimes called the New England heresy, the Worcesters in New England. Their idea was that a minister was to preach from his own love and goodness, and truth was to be from that. And they did not accept the divine authority of the writings, so that their personal goodness was from that in which they were to preach, and in which the truth of the church came. And from that, on account of that, they quoted many things in the writings about truth from good. thousands of times, and why does it speak of truth from good or faith from charity? And the Academy had fought that heresy. There's also another heresy called Thomas Lake Harris, who said that Swedenborg had given the internal sense, the spiritual sense of the word, and that he was giving the celestial sense of the word. Well, due to that, due to these things which the Academy fought, they had came to have maybe a prejudice against the teaching of truth from good, which we so often find in the word, and they couldn't separate it from their thinking because they put the emphasis on the divine authority of the writings, as they called them, and this seemed to do away with that. And so when the doctrine of the church was spiritual from a celestial origin, what is the same as truth from good, it was connected in their minds with these former heresies that had been so destructive of the church. In that way we can understand how there were those who sincerely could feel that this was a very dangerous heresy. Fourth, there was with many of the simple a feeling of loyalty to the church as they knew it. Now you see, a loyalty to the church is a very important thing. A love and loyalty to the church. And where that is lacking, then the spirit of the church fails. Now, there's only one reason for leaving a church, and that is that one's first loyalty should be to the word. And if a person feels that church is not loyal to the word and the teaching of the word, then their loyalty has to be to the word and not to the church. Now, in what we have to say, it must be clear that we, while describing what took place, that this does not involve any judgment as to the internal itself of others, because we do not know the internal of others. And there are those who may fight for the truth, and yet their internal may be mixed with motives that are, the ruling motive may not be good, while there are those who fight against the truth, and they may have a mixed motives that internally may excuse them. Therefore, we must regard this spiritual warfare as a representative things of the things in the spiritual world, not think of it primarily from person. It was a warfare went on in the spiritual world, and it's represented on what took place in the church. The birth of the doctrine of the church is described in the Apocalypse as the birth of the man-child. And the opposition to it is represented by the dragon and its angels. This does not mean that those who defended the truth were necessarily, as to their person, Michaels, and nor that those who opposed it were dragons. Still, in the warfare, they represented it. You see, a person may defend the truth for various reasons. We're told that devils, when they're taken up into the world of spirits and certain light is given them from heaven, as long as their will is not active, they can see the truth just as well as anyone else. Therefore, if the things of the will are not active, or not in opposition, anyone can who has a normal mind can see the truth. It's usually things of the will which prevent it. Sometimes those things of the will may have a certain innocence. People are loyal to the church, feel a loyalty to the church they're in. That prevents them to see it. While sometimes those who are who do not have a good will are maybe have a rebellious nature and are opposed to the authorities from reasons that are not good in themselves, and from that they are in a state where they're glad to see it, to come to a truth which criticizes the church they're in. As a matter of fact, you see, of those who left the church later on, over half did not remain faithful to this church, but left it. Therefore, it's questionable whether they, in their fighting for the truth, some of them were very active in the fight, were if they did it out of a genuine motive. We may never think of ourselves as being good because we see the truth and defend it. Because, as I say, the motives may be good or they may not be good. And therefore, we must not despise others because they don't see the truth, or you may not feel proud and vain of ourselves because we see the truth and defend it. We read, the Holy Spirit, which is meant by the Holy, which is meant by the Holy Spirit, does not inhere, neither does it remain, except so long as the man who receives it both believes in the Lord, and at the same time in the doctrine of the truth from the Word, and in the life according to it. We have seen how some who even gave very valuable things to the church later on went away from them. For example, one of the very valuable things that was given to the church by the Holy Spirit was the name of the church. It was first seen by Hendrik Boof, who later on left the church and went into very foolish things. At this time, I was an assistant pastor in the cathedral and on the consistory of Bishop N.D. Pendleton. Very often in these consistory meetings, there was a violent atmosphere there. In fact, my wife used to say, when I went to these, she compared it to Daniel in the lion's den. There was a correspondence went on between Mr. Grunewald and Bishop de Charmes. Whenever a letter came from Holland, that correspondence, it acted like a violent bomb that caused an intense explosion in those meetings. So those meetings were so intense that I had to take tranquilizer. The doctor gave me tranquilizer to be able to stand them. And they were often quite intense. Finally, the bishop took pity on me and told me I didn't have to come to all of the meetings. To illustrate something of the nature of these meetings, the bishop one time gave a long speech. Got rather dramatic on the vanity and pride and self-conceit and thinking that a man was in the divine truth from the Word. And that was what came to him as a leer stood for. After the meeting, after his speech, I said that my experience was just rather the opposite. I had read the Third Testament many times, and I thought I knew it all and pretty well. And that with Hamas Alir, I came to realize that what I understood was very, very little, and that I felt more or less back in kindergarten. And, it was a very humiliating experience where you think you know it so much, and then you find that you only are in the things of the letter, and you know hardly anything of the internal. The bishop replied, "Well, we're not going to get into an argument at who is the humbler, you or me." In other words, one of the problems was they always took to a personal plane when the question was not a question of person, but of the doctrine. Now the meetings, the atmosphere became the most intense in the meetings of 1933, the ministers' meetings of 1933, when Mr. Pfeiffer came over in the spring of 1933. There are the reports of these meetings in the New Church Life, and the reports of the 33 and 34 meetings are quite accurate because they were taken down by a stenographer. Mr. Cranch took them stenographic notes, but they were sent out to each of the persons, each of the ministers, and they were given the privilege of going over and making corrections and so forth. There may have been slight changes, but in any case, it's a pretty accurate account of the meetings of 33 and 34. In the meeting of 37, which was the third of those meetings, I requested that we have a stenographic report of it, but the bishop refused. And the notes were taken by the secretary, Mr. Whitehead, and they showed a good deal of prejudice. It's not an accurate account of those meetings, that meeting of 37. Now, in the formal meetings, there was a certain restraint due to the fact that when you have a formal meeting, you have a good deal of restraint due to the formality of the meeting. The times when it became much more violent was in between the meeting, just after or just before. And during those meetings of 33, a kind of madness came over the whole atmosphere. A kind of insanity. Between the meetings there was shouting. It was like a almost like a madhouse. When you get that atmosphere, people are not entirely responsible. Sometimes that's fear. It's a saying, all hell breaks loose. Well, I think that was literally true then. Hell did break loose at that meeting, particularly in 33. The meeting was opened by a paper by Bishop Indy Pendleton. He read it quite dramatically, and finally he closed in a stentorian voice, bringing his fists violently into his other palm and saying, "This is intolerable. It cannot be borne." Well, that set sort of the atmosphere for the meetings, you see. Now, after that statement of the bishop, I arose and said that I didn't understand how a bishop had gotten the idea that we believed what he, and ideas as such as he expressed them in his paper. Many of the things he said we believed, I was against them just as strongly as he was. And that I felt he'd quite misunderstood the Hema Salir. I couldn't understand how he had gotten the ideas he did. But he had taken certain passages which he drew his ideas from, and that it was still difficult for me to see how he thought that we held the ideas such as he expressed them. The next day he announced that he would read this paper to the whole society. That came sort of a shock after we had said that we felt he had misunderstood it, we ought to go into it further, but his explanation was that this thing was being talked about by everybody in Vrindavan, and they ought to hear what had actually been said in his paper. In the society meeting, many people thought there was a very tense and heated atmosphere, but relatively to the ministers' meetings, it was relatively very quiet. Paul Sinisvet, during the meeting, got up and said, "What we needed was more light and less heat." That tended to calm the atmosphere somewhat. The bishop, in reading the paper, he had read it slowly and dramatically in the ministers' meetings. But in the society meeting, he read it very quietly and quickly and without any emphasis, and finally ended up by saying, "This is intolerable, it can't be borne." So the atmosphere was quite different there. Now, in the 7 or 8 months later, the Christmas of 1933, the atmosphere again, the whole feeling had been intense, and there was talk of we would have to be separated. And many of us thought we would be forced out at that time. It just happened that there were about seven in the Christmas tableaus who in agreement with the Haman Salir. Most of them were teachers, Elmo Acton, and wives of ministers. And it was a very tragic Christmas celebration. There were many tears shed because that group had a love for the academy and a love for the church. I'd say that when it came to the separation, I was the only one of that group that left the general church. Now, in the meeting of 1934, Mr. Bjork was at some of those meetings. I don't think he wasn't at the last. It was that time that the doctrine of human goods and truths was the center of talk. The goods and truths of the church were just human goods and truths. Mr. Reverend Carl Alden got up and said, well, he thought the worst thing of the Haman Salir was that it made the general church formulate the doctrine of human goods and truths. He never believed in human doctrine before then. At the end of this meeting, I was sitting at one end of the chancel hall, the door was the other. I said that I thought that the council had made doctrine in the council in a way that the writing said was not to be done, and that I considered it a very serious matter that in the motion of the time they had made this doctrine, that the doctrine of the general church. It was about the time for the meeting to stop. No one said a word. Dead silence for about 5 minutes. Finally, I got up and walked out and left the others there. So those things were quite dramatic at that time. In this connection, you might say that the essential difference between the academy and general church is that we believe that the divine goods and truths can be in man, thus that the Lord can be in man, while the general church takes a position that took the position particularly at that time that the divine, the goods and truths when they entered man were only human. In this connection, I'd like to read a number. The Lord is present in man according to the reception of him. Other things man does not acknowledge but rejects. For in order that the Lord may operate anything with man by faith, the Lord's divine must be present in man and not outside of him. That's Apocalypse Explained, 915, paragraph 8. The Lord's divine must be present in man, not outside of him. Now, in that connection, think about the Word. Now, the Word, of course, as a book, has words that represent them. The divine things of the heaven and the church and of the Lord himself. But if you take a book, just as a book, paper and ink, and with letters in certain shapes and curves and lines, that was all there was to it. If no one read it, it would not be, there would be nothing divine in the world. Or if, supposing you had the three testaments in Hebrew, Greek, and Latin, you had them in the shrine and worshipped them, but there was nobody who could read Hebrew, Greek, or Latin in the world, would still have nothing of the divine. So there, you can't speak of the divine of the Word apart from angels and men. Because the Word, this is a book, paper and ink isn't divine. Later, the bishop stopped me preaching in the cathedral for a number of years. Sometimes I went to France where there was a congregation of about 28 persons in the place in France, about 20 children and 12, maybe not quite that many children, but about 12 adults who weren't all members of the church. Most of them were Dutch. There were three English. So I was busy there, and it was a relief for me to be there, and also probably a relief for those in Bernathen to have me out of there. But I don't remember just when, but finally, I think it was in 36, the bishop said that the atmosphere had quieted down. I could preach and give classes again, provided I did not do it to teach to him and Salir. Well, I said that I would not pick any text for that purpose, but when I would write a sermon on a text, I could only preach what I saw in the text. I couldn't, if that, he thought that agreed with the hymn as a lyre, I couldn't help that. I couldn't preach anything but what I saw in the text. I would neither try to bring it in, nor could I try to keep it out. I would have to preach what I saw in the text. Well, he accepted that. So I was given a chance to preach. He also gave me permission to hold classes in my house for those who wished to come. And there were about sometimes as many 30 as 35 at those classes. And they all were very interested in those things. I felt free to speak about more directly about the things that we believe. But then, finally, I gave doctrinal classes and sermons to the whole congregation. Those four sermons which I gave were published, and also six doctrinal classes. You may have read those, you may know about them. The last sermon that I gave in the cathedral, when I came off the chancel before I unrobed, Bishop de Charmes said I would never be allowed to preach again in the cathedral. No, you can read that sermon, and I think you will see that the things that he objected to were really the quotations in the sermon, because I don't think there was much else that he could object to, but in any case, he was felt that way. When I started giving these doctrinal classes, they were having a very small attendance in the Bernathen, the doctrinal classes. But when I started, it seemed to arouse interest, and they got about two or three times as large, which I think also disturbed some people. Now, in the spring of 37, Mr. Bjork had criticized Bishop N.D. Pendleton and leaders of the church. And Bishop Independent called a meeting to consider disciplining and maybe expelling Mr. Bjork. Now, Dr. Unry had written a poem, a very profane poem, in which he about Hamas Salir, in which he compared us to a description of a demons in the spiritual in the other world who came and took the caps off these people that were talking, and he implying that and the devils had come taken our hats away. And that upset my brother Raymond. So when Bishop spoke of discipline of Mr. Bjork, Brother Raymond said that he thought that Dr. Unrich should also be disciplined for this poem he had written. Now that got the meeting in entire confusion, with the result that they didn't do anything. And 3 days later, Bishop N.D. Pendon resigned as Bishop of the General Church. Georgia Charms was chosen as Bishop of the General Church. In relation to Mr. Bjork and the Bishop and myself, the Bishop at one time said to me that of all the ministers in the General Church, he was the most fond of Mr. Bjork. He was also, the Bishop and I were also very close. I used to go to his house and have coffee 3-4 times a week and take an automobile rides. And he took me always when he went on trips, Episcopal trips in this country and in Europe. And we were very close. And I think that he sort of felt that Mr. Bjork and I were betraying his friendship by not being loyal to him in relation to the problems of the church. He didn't realize that we viewing things above a plane of person, and that it was not a question of personal loyalty should not rule. In one of these very disturbed states, I wrote a letter to Mr. Bjork and one to Bishop de Charms. I put them in the wrong envelopes. That caused quite a problem, which I was rather critical, although I didn't say very much in the letter that I hadn't said meetings or things. But Georgia Charm said if I came, he'd give the letter back. So I went. Then he changed his mind and said he couldn't give the letter back, because it belonged to the church and it wasn't his personal letter. I didn't at first realize why he didn't want to give that church. I think I came to the idea that the probable reason was this. In that letter, I had described a conversation I had with Bishop Acton. Now, Bishop Acton was taking a somewhat moderating position, attitude. And he didn't agree with the bishop calling it a heresy. He said it should not be called a heresy. And he was somewhat critical of Georgia Charms. In fact, I think I said something about Bishop being critical of Georgia Charms in this letter. He said, of course, we English can't quite understand these French people. Georgia Charms was French, you see. And now, I think that the reason why George wanted that letter was to hold a sort of a club over Bishop Acton, because after that, Acton said never anything to moderate. He didn't say another word. Well, when the time when Mr. Groenevelt, Mr. Pfeiffer came in 1937 for the 37 meetings, it was generally felt that the separation might be forced at that time. And a group of the leading laymen in Brenhatton asked to meet with me. My brother Raymond took one of the leading parts in that. And they were very much opposed to any separation. They said they wouldn't let the ministers make a separation. They would fight. They didn't want a separation at all. That subject will come up again. When Mr. Pfeiffer and Mr. Groenevelt arrived, we had a meeting with the bishop and his consistory. We requested that, as Mr. Groenevelt had come over, that he be at that meeting. They refused to permit Mr. Groenevelt to attend that meeting because he was a layman. So during all those meetings, Mr. Groenevelt was not at any of the meetings. Now, the question was, what was to be done? See, earlier in these years, we'd been fighting very hard to prevent a separation. And the idea of a separation distressed us very much. But after so many years of trials, we had resigned ourselves of having a separation if necessary. So we met to consider what was to be done. Mr. Pfeiffer, who during these meetings was at his best, and even when the things were most violent, he was the most calm man of all. And especially in the 33 meeting, he behaved himself with such wisdom that even those who were most strongly against him couldn't help admiring the way he conducted himself. Well, this meeting in the consistory, Mr. Pfeiffer said that both sides felt they needed a freedom, and that the state where they didn't feel free, that was is no longer possible, but he thought that it was very important for the church that there should not be a complete break, and therefore that there should be still a certain unity preserved. It would be harmful to the church, and also to the church in relation to the world, to have a complete break, and therefore it was proposed that we'll have a Dutch diocese and an American diocese, and the diocese with the general church, the rest of the general church. And we had agreed that Mr. Pfeiffer proposed that he would become a bishop. How about a theological school? And it was felt that each diocese should have its own theological school. Well, at the end said, well, Holland not criticize any longer? Mr. Pfeiffer said, he couldn't promise that. Criticism might become more. And that, I think, he may have made a mistake in making that statement. That broke up a meeting, and that was the end of that. Now, in the ministers' meetings, the bishop, Pendleton, commenced by making a statement that when the hemisphere first appeared, he said it was one of the worst heresies that had existed in the church, and the time had come that part we must. Now, nearly all of the ministers got up and supported the bishop's statement that time had come that we had part we must, and it was put on the basis of heresy. But later in the meeting, Mr. Pfeiffer said that in making the doctrine of human goods and truths and putting the divine things of the church outside of the church, the church separated itself from the Lord. That was a doctrinal statement, but of course they took it personally, and the bishop, De Charmes, who is now the bishop of the church, said, you charged me with separating myself from the Lord. Mr. Pfeiffer said he wasn't making any personal judgment of the bishop. He didn't know the internal of the bishop. He suppose that he had separated himself from the Lord. He was making a statement that by putting the divine outside of the church, separated from the Lord. But Bishop insisted that he was making the charge that he was being separated from the Lord. And then he said that on account of that statement of Mr. Pfeiffer, he was causing a disturbance in the church, and that he would have to be removed on the grounds of causing a disturbance. Now, then it was said, well, it wasn't a matter of doctrine and heresy, it was just a matter of disturbance. The day before, it was all a matter of heresy. Now it wasn't a matter of heresy, it was a matter of disturbance. The Bishop of Charmes was then authorized by the council to take any action he saw fit in regard to Mr. Pfeiffer. No action was taken during the meeting. The Council of the Clergy authorized Bishop De Charmes to take any action he saw fit in regard to the disturbance. Now, then this matter was referred to the Joint Council, ministers and laymen. I was not present at that meeting, but probably the notes of Mr. Whitehead were read, which I don't believe gave an accurate account of what had taken place in the council meeting. Now, this action of Bishop De Charmes in changing it from a matter of heresy to a matter of disturbance was a very astute political move, because there were maybe 15 persons who, if it had been put on the grounds of heresy, would have been felt compelled to leave the church, but who didn't leave the church on the ground of disturbance. Also, in this meeting I had with the laymen before, you see, the laymen were opposed to a separation. But there was a general dislike of Mr. Pfeiffer, and to have Mr. Pfeiffer removed, they did not take any stand against it. They went along with it. If it had been on the grounds of heresy and forcing a separation that way, the layman may have protested, you see, due to the fact that it was Mr. Pfeiffer who had made a disturbance. They went along with the council of the clergy. So Mr. Pfeiffer was not tried properly, nor was there any accurate record of the meeting which led to that decision. 3 days later, Bishop de Charmes crossed Mr. Pfeiffer's name off the list of the clergy and off the list of membership of the general church. After that, a short time after that, I spoke at doctrinal class and asked them to reconsider the matter and made a plea. But there was no, to the congregation, but as I naturally expected, I got no support, and I resigned as assistant pastor at that meeting and shortly afterwards from the general church. Now, we had a meeting of those who were separating to consider the appointing a bishop. So we had agreed to Mr. Pfeiffer being the bishop when we were in the at the meeting with the consistory. He took for granted that he was to be bishop. Mr. Hunevelt said, we were now free and we didn't have it, there was no haste, and that thing, it had to be considered. The result that no action. I think we can see in Providence how through this meeting with the consistory, the church would avoid it, what would have been a very grievous situation. The following summer, Bishop Andy Pendleton was up at his summer place in the mountains, and I was told that he was walking up and down like a lion all summer. He said, "Have I done right, and what have I done wrong in bringing about that separation?" Bishop Pendleton had often said that Bishop Benet had been too sharp in making the separations. He praised his brother, who was 20 years older, Bishop W.F. Pendleton, for preserving unity and not letting controversies get out of hand. So he'd gone against his principle, his own principle, and he was very much distressed by it, I think. And he died shortly after that, I think. May have had a great deal to do with his early death after the meeting. Now, what is the state of the church now and compared with the, say, church then, say, the general church? See, we don't have any of that violence, and there's a more friendly attitude with many. But that doesn't necessarily, that with some that may be good, but with some it may be just that They've lost interest in doctrinal matters. People don't go to war about things they're not interested in. For instance, at one time there were crusades and wars about between churches, because it was something very vital to them. You don't have those wars except in Ireland nowadays, because people are, they'll go to war about something they love and care for, but they won't go to war about religion, because they're not enough interested in religion to go to war about it. So that it's easy to be friendly and not when there's a very intense love of doctrine. So that we can't judge that state either. As to these, my talks I've given here, I think it is better if you don't mention them to others, because it wouldn't be wise to arouse people's thinking about them at this time. So I think it's better not to talk about them with others. The grace of the Lord Jesus Christ be with us all. Amen.